Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. My name is... Hold on. Good evening, everybody, or afternoon. My name is Kurt Weller. This is the first episode of 3001 with Kurt Weller with Bob Dobbs. And as is the case with Blog Talk Radio, and believe me, I'm not looking a gift horse in the mouth. It's free, and I understand that there's going to be some technical difficulties. And I understand that, and I forgive. But I am unable at the moment to access my switchboard. And so I was unable to stop that song from going through the whole thing. But I'm hoping that that's going to be taken care of in future episodes. I think here's Bob. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Kurt. I'm great. What's new about this situation, this show?
Okay, this... You were a frequent guest on the Plaza of the Mind Ideologue series.
Yeah.
And I thought the Plaza of the Mind Ideologue series was going to be a show that featured multiple guests. And I thought... Wow, Bob and I have been doing we did six or seven shows on there. So I thought, Why not just make a Kurt and Bob show? It's basically the same show. And the reason that this is called Episode 3001 is because you appeared on both Episode 3001 of the Old Outer Channel show, and you also appeared on episode 3001 of the Plaza of the Mind Ideologue series. So I thought, why don't we just call this episode 3001, featuring Kurt Weller and Bob Dobbs. And then that way, it's a given that this is a show about our conversations on media ecology, the Android meme, and most recently your foray into the world of the non-physical through Ion.
Yeah, that was fun a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I have to say, that's one of my favorite episodes I've done yet.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. So, you know, not right this second, but you were kind of breaking up slightly. Is that your technical thing? Are we in a new technology, a different thing here?
It seems like every time Blog Talk Radio gets a little bigger, they cut a little more from the free format. So, like, right now they're giving us an hour slot for the new show.
Right.
But the way that that works is it's usually an hour free streaming. And then you can go longer than an hour. It's just guests can't call in. So the important thing for anybody out there, if they do want to call in, is to get in before that hour is up. So it's 3 p.m. Pacific time right now. We'll want to squeeze in any potential callers before 4 o'clock. And
right.
The call-in number is 1-646-378-1758. If people I use Skype to do the show, and it's super cheap. It ends up costing like like 5 cents a minute, or I could do like a 3-hour show and it costs me about $2. So if anybody's got that Skype technology, they can use that. That's my plug for them. But yeah, so that was my idea for the new show, and I thought we'd just keep going with what we had been doing, but you know, it would just be dedicated show. And plus, I don't know, I kind of like, I'm like, you know, what do you know about George Lucas?
Nelson Thal met him about 1990. You know, Nelson Thal was a regular on my show with Mike Dyer. He'd call in reports. He was called Tom Rich, and so he'd say, well, Tom Rich is on assignment. And we were working with Mary McLuhan, Marsha McLuhan's daughter, who lived in San Francisco, and Nelson went out to hang out with her in 1991. And you can actually hear on my timeline when she calls in during that period he's out there. But Nelson described a party where Jerry Brown was there, because Mary was Secretary of Education, a very high bureaucratic position in the late 70s, so she was a good friend of Jerry Brown. And George Lucas was there, and a bunch of other people that Mary was in Mary's social circle. And Nelson, not that he's any judge of anybody, but I found it interesting, he found George Lucas rather dull. And that's the only contact I've had, is Nelson's impressions. And he found Jerry Brown was rather empty-headed. But, you know, Nelson's a bit of a megalomaniac. He's proven that even more lately. So I don't know if that's valid. I love American Graffiti. That's right up my alley, you know, that movie.
How so?
I just love the music of that. You know, when I came to the States in 1953 to New York, you can read my diary. I'm there with my father's friend, Marcel Duchamp, and that's when I met Garrett Dean, saw him in the distance in the club, and then met him more in detail a few years later in Halifax, in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. But that was the first time I heard rock and roll when I came from Paris, and a lot of, you know, doo-wop stuff on the New York stations. I mean, that's the perfect place to be initiated into pop and rock, and doo-wop is in New York City. That was so amazing, that music, to me. You know, it hit my emotional timbre or resonance or whatever it is, and I never stopped. I love all that stuff. I like, you know, mainstream top 40 hits. I like obscure stuff. I can't sing. I'm a lousy musician, probably, but good dancer. And so I got no taste. So I like what I like. You know, and what?
I was going to say, that's true, I think, of most people that are, like, in touch with the reality of how things work.
Yeah, like, I'm doing this rock critics thing with Scott Woods, which is incredible. I'm explaining Richard Meltzer's book, Aesthetics of Rock. It's probably never been done before. It's a friend of mine heard the show, the discussion we did a week or two ago, number 12. He says the greatest thing he's ever heard in his life. And if you don't like me talking, I play an Ed McMahon to Ion on Cashflow. But if you want the old Bob McLuhan tactility talk, you can get this on the rock critics thing we're doing. And I was just, we were going through Meltzer's Aesthetics of Rock, and he was talking about a Bobby V song, how silly it was compared to, you know, the Beatles or Dylan or something. And he named the title, and immediately the song came to my mind. It's probably a song in American Graffiti, Take Good Care of My Baby, I think it is. And I immediately said, wow, that's a great song, you know. So Marin Graffiti crystallized all that. It's just a beautiful, it's the California dream place of the 50s. You know, yeah, it was about late 50s, early 60s, right? When Richard Dreyfuss is driving around the town. It's just the perfect image of California before the oil spills and all that. So the environment is good. The interaction among the teenagers and the music's great. It's the perfect. Now, I didn't grow up in that kind of situation, so it's all a fantasy to me, and I thought it was neat. So I like American Graffiti. When that came out, I said, this guy's great. And then he did, was it Star Wars or Star Trek? No, Star Wars.
Star Wars.
And that stuff is a bit corny to me. I don't get this big, dramatic, cliche symphonic music. It's corny. You know what I mean? that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that's true for a lot of people. Like I was like the perfect age for Star Wars, so I like eat it up with a spoon. And the original. I was the perfect age, I think, for Star Wars. I was 6 years old when the first one came out, and I like went ape shit. Along with just about everybody in my generation, I think. So I eat it up. I mean, I love it. And when I was a kid, I didn't realize he was basically referencing everything. You know,
it was your doo-wop music. See, you're young, you're programmable, and so it's forever embedded in you. Yeah, and so that music programmed me, even though I was in my 30s. It was, you know, I can't really say. You're talking about children's sort of amazing movie for kids. Doo-wop music wasn't for children, you know. Rock wasn't for children, so it's a bit different.
Right.
But when you're imprinted at an early impressionable stage, that stuff stays with you forever. It's not going to go away.
Yeah. And that was my introduction to the whole, you know, like all the tropes that, like, you know, like the battle against the father, the.
Yeah, all that Freudian and Jungian stuff that, you know, Lucas was informed by Joseph Campbell, right?
Yes, he was, yeah, the hero with a thousand faces.
Yeah, you know, that famous series of interviews with Campbell by Bill Moyers, I think was filmed in George Lucas's a museum or estate or something. Did you ever hear of that?
Skywalker Ranch.
Oh, okay.
Yep,
that's what it is. Skywalker Ranch, I guess.
Well, the reason I brought Lucas up is just because I feel like he's I don't know if you know this, but he's notorious for fiddling with his movies, and he's constantly kind of remaking and remixing and tinkering with
movies. He's
obsessed.
He's obsessive compulsive disorder kind of relationship to it, right?
Right, and that's kind of how I feel with my stuff, is I feel like I'm always fiddling with it. That's why I decided I had to start a new show, a new Kurt and Bob show. So
is this part of the fiddling process, the fetish, the obsessive compulsive disorder, niggling with it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I'm always trying to get it to be the perfect vehicle, and I felt like it wasn't the perfect vehicle on the other show. Because the intent of the other show was somewhat different, it evolved,
right.
And I thought, since it evolved, I couldn't just leave well enough alone. I had to kind of just start a new thing, but it's not a new thing, but I think you know what
I'm talking. How about this? I'm just dimly aware of it, but you interviewed some of your heroes in Plasma of the Mind, right? You interviewed, wanted to have personal contact with the guys who programmed you when you were young.
Yeah, like it's kind of like I only interview people that I respect their work or that's had an influence on me. And I've been able to interview a lot of really great people, you know, that like, you know, and it's like it's like a really cool kind of thing for me to like talk to Bob Dobbs, talk to Jamil Nasir, who's a great author. It's just a cool thing. I've got one next week coming up with Nancy Ferguson, who's this actress who I've totally loved for the last 20 years. So it's a neat thing, you know. It's
yeah, you had to have a forum. You have to have a medium to. You have to have your TV, your chip body, for them to acknowledge you.
Exactly.
They wouldn't talk to you unless it's kind of publicity for them, you know, however small.
Right.
You got it.
And I understand that, and it's, you know, and it's cool. You know, a lot of people have declined the offer, and I don't take it personally. You know, I get it. But, yeah, it's been a good thing.
Now, here's what I would say, Kurt. Kurt, I would say that though I went out, none of them could talk to you as long as I can and about ongoing things and bring in new factors. So I won the Plasma Mind. I made the final team, the one who gets his own dialogue with you, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's true.
I was the best mind you could do the Plasma on. The Plasma you saw from my mind was the most self-sustaining, and most doesn't stop.
It's the unstoppability factor.
You
don't seem to get you don't mind the unstoppability.
I don't mind that nobody's listening. You know, you don't have to have publicity. You don't have to be. I'd talk to you on the phone if it wasn't recorded. You know, broadcast. Ion says it's almost to a fault. Bob will talk to anybody.
You know, my grandpa was like that. He could talk to any fucking buddy. It didn't matter who they were, what walk of life they were. And I respect that.
Who was this? Did you say your grandfather?
Yeah, my grandfather.
Your grandfather did that. Oh, you know, I was on a site.
He could talk to anybody, anytime, and he never changed his persona. It was always just him.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I respected that, you know?
You know, I was scrolling through some Facebooks, Mike Dyer, and you know how it says people in common or something? You get on some site and then your bride shows up. Oh yeah, I have Carolyn in common, you know, with myself. But I saw a picture of you, a different picture, not a profile, but like you're looking up. Never saw that picture of you. I've never seen your full face really. Other than the one in the with the hood on you, you know, fagging it up in the beach supposedly. They call
that
you a fag in that one.
That was a fun picture, yeah.
Yeah,
I don't mind being called a faggot. You know, whatever. It's
yeah, I mean, I'm gay myself, so I'm allowed to use the word.
I figure like the more anger I can fucking the more it's good to
Are you referring to the word? No, you're just vaguely, you know, just blurring out here. Are you? What's all good? The fact that we could say faggot? Is that what you're referring to?
No, I'm just saying I don't care really what if people want to like post a picture of me and make fun of my masculinity. More power to you. I don't really care.
Yeah, you're a modern person. You have no identity. You're not like your father and grandfather. They had identities back then. They were serious what they were. Whatever they were.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, you know, and yeah, like, you know, if you would have called my grandpa a faggot, he'd have whipped your ass, you know. But...
he would have made sure that you understood.
Yeah.
He would have made sure that you understood that he wasn't one.
Right. Exactly.
Whereas you don't give a damn if someone says it, which you can say on a simple level. There's so many people in the world, the anonymity is so big, you can't really care, right? You don't have any community that's watching you.
No. It's you know, like it's all good. Like the song says, it's all good.
Yeah. Relax and allow, and there's no negatives.
Right.
Say that.
So,
that's a new thing. I'm not saying it's all good now anymore. I hardly ever say it, but, you know, it's a cliche. I'm going to say there's no negative. No possible negative thought. You can't think positively. You can't think positively because there's no negative thought. You just think, and there's no negative or positive on any thinking you do. It's just the thing. The thought is what it is.
You just think it is what it is and
enjoy it.
Yeah.
So isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Did you say ape?
I said if you want to hate somebody, you know,
that's
a thought.
Well, you don't even have to hate. You just you have violent thoughts. That's no problem. If you have violent thoughts directed towards.
No, I don't think so. I think it's natural.
But it's hardly ever been said. Everybody's trying to think positive. You know, they sell. It's a big industry, thinking positive. I say you can't think positively. You can't think negatively either. But can
you
just enjoy your thinking?
That's right. If it's got a service or a disservice.
Yeah, in the context it's in. And usually you probably have no disservice.
Right.
But then Ion says, you know, we do need contrast, require contrast, so we know how good we're feeling. If you didn't have any contrast, you wouldn't know the bliss you were having.
Exactly. That Ion,
okay.
I enjoyed that Ion thing.
Well, you should go on informationfarm.blogspot.com. Ed here in the Hawaiian island called Kauai, he glommed on to cash flow and has been listening to Ion, you know, since Ion and Carolyn were on with me last October. He loves Ion. He had a private reading, and he's turned this big website, many people go to it around the world, into propaganda for Ion, into some great Ion things he cobbles together. As a matter of fact, today... Go ahead.
I was going to say, actually, I don't know. Do you use, like, I use this thing called Google Reader, and it kind of basically, whenever, like, one of your favorite websites posts something new, it'll bring a little notification, like a little email that'll tell you. And so I subscribe to Information Farm, so I've been checking out that, and there is a lot. It's Ion heavy.
Yeah, and did you just do that lately, or you were doing it 3-4 months ago?
No, I did it probably in the last week or two since we've been after like Ion came on the show.
Yeah,
and
he brought up the information. Right, no, it's good. It's good site. So what we're going to do starting today, later today, I'm going to Ed and I and Ion are going to review all the fringe weirdos that. Project Camelot features, that Information Farm features. We're going to go through them all, and it'll be the first time fringe alternative opinion making or media will have a critic judging and clarifying what these people are saying. You know, everybody from Alex Jones to David Icke and Benjamin Fulford and everybody in between. So it's going to be the first time. So Ion's going to sort of like a teacher mark everybody's grades, mark everybody's papers.
That sounds very cool.
Yeah.
And what site? Where is this going to be?
It'll be put on Information Farm.
Okay.
Probably by tomorrow because Ed's a very fast editor, and he sent me the samples. We're going to play samples of these different people saying stuff and play it to Ion, and then he'll clarify what they leave out or what they're. Correct on, what they're not correct on. It's going to be the first, it's actually marking, correcting the information swirl we're in. If you believe Ion, if you accept what Ion says. You know, I consider Ion the anti-environment to the internet. I don't need the internet if I got Ion because he can tell me what's happening better than anybody else can.
Yeah, and you sent me an email. I haven't watched the video yet, but that's actually that phenomenon you told me about where was that the Android meme attacking Ion or what?
Oh, okay. You're not talking about the video where you see the optical illusions, not that. The waviness. You're talking about where I said Ion invades JW's computer.
Right.
Right. Okay, so I don't know if I talked about it a couple weeks ago, but pretty quickly, once we started Dupes of Non-Physical, which is a forum for people who have readings with Ion, JW, his computer started broadcasting YouTubes. They just emit out of his, you know, out of the speakers of his computer. And if his computer was hooked up to Bose speakers, which he has, it would just boom in the room. So this went on for a day or so, and he got very irritated after a while, so he shut off his computer from Wi-Fi and the internet and everything else, took the battery out. He disconnected the whole computer, and his kids were pissed when they came home from school. They couldn't get on the internet. So, and he had very, you know, very advanced firewalls and all that stuff, but he disconnected everything to stop the broadcasting that ION was doing, because it turned out every time ION would post a YouTube on our Dupes of Non-Physical Forum, the computer would start playing it, you know, interrupt the quietness or serenity in JW's home. So he shut it down, and it didn't work. The computer kept broadcasting, the YouTubes for the next couple of days. So he gave up and then rehooked everything up, and so his kids got back on the internet, and they were happy. So he's kind of gotten used to it. But half a week ago, we were going to Skype and look at his property. He scorched part of his lawn there. And you can hear that story on Tailgate. And so he wanted to show it to me through Skype. But he called up and said his Skype was jammed. He can't make the little pointer, the browser on his computer go. It was frozen, the computer. But it was still playing YouTubes, okay? It was frozen, but playing YouTube. Yes. So he called up the company that can monitor his computer, the repair shop, so to speak, whoever they are, and they can, from remote, look at his computer. And they looked at it. Here was frozen. They said, there's nothing wrong with your computer, JW. It's perfect. But here's the anomaly. Most computers, the bit exchange or the work of processing, however you say it, is at 20 megahertz. And they told him that there was the most megahertz computer was one in Missouri. It operated bit exchange, bit processing at 60 megahertz. Well, according to their meter, JW's was operating at 105 megahertz. And they said, this is impossible. What the hell's going on over there? And I don't know if JW told them about ION. I doubt it. But ION has revved up, has turned his computer into a supercomputer because it's processing so much, scanning the whole Dupes and Non-Physical Forum and posting constantly to everybody and posting YouTubes. And it turned out that any YouTube that was posted on the site by someone else on the forum would broadcast. So JW said the other day he and his family were having the little family dinner, right, nice and proper and familial. All of a sudden, they hear me talking, and someone on the site had posted my last interview before I came to Maui in May 2008. You might have seen it. I'm sitting on the beach, Venice Beach, and I'm explaining what tattoos mean and what the studs mean as relation to the TV body and chip body. It goes on.
That sounds good, though.
Yeah, and so he's sitting there with his family, and all of a sudden, they hear me broadcasting in the other room. Hear me talking. And JW says, I don't know what you were saying, Bob. It was the most ridiculous crap I'd ever heard. But they put up with it for 10 minutes, then the YouTube stopped. But that's what's going on in his home. So he couldn't get his email going. Skype was screwed up, but he called last night and said his email is going. So I think Carolyn talked to him this morning, and maybe it's fixed. So I got to find out, did those guys come over and look at it? Are they curious about the 105 megahertz? So it remains to be seen what happened. But it's basically his house is haunted, you know, an old cliche term. She got a ghost there, but it's ION, which is a non-physical and can point out ghosts. It's not a ghost, but in stereotypical terms, a ghost is they should get, you know, one of those programs over there and film his home, right?
Oh, yeah. What's that show called? The Ghost Hunter?
Yeah. Ghost hunters.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that reminds me. You know what I call us, me, Carolyn, and JW? We're not Ghostbusters. We're Guff Busters.
Guff Busters.
Yeah, G-U-F. The Guff is where our non-physical goes when we die, when we transition. It's, quote, heaven.
Okay.
It's a Hebrew word.
Okay.
And the Guff is emptying. You can listen on my howionic.com, go into the About ION part of that site and hear this audio talking. It's from March 24th Tailgate, where ION, in the 11th hour, described how the big picture, how the Guff is emptying and what's going to happen to humanity. So
wow.
It's huge. It's the biggest scenario you could ever imagine. Like, where we go, there's going to be so many people die here at sort of a short period of time that the guff won't be able to accept them all. It'll be too filled up, so they'll spill back here. And then they'll be forced to be immortal by in the physical by default. Whereas those that are hip to all this will be immortal not by default. But the guff is emptying because it's going to become too full. So now you've never heard that thought before. That's the most fantastic thought you could ever think. Heaven is too full. It's going to empty, so heaven's going to come here. This is the main big picture point from Ion laid out over the past year.
Well, do you remember that line? You've seen Dawn of the Dead, right? The original one?
Yeah, Night of the Living Dead.
Well, the sequel, Dawn of the Dead?
I think I've seen both, yeah.
Remember the line from that where he says, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth? This is kind of like the opposite of that.
That's a good point. Well, you know, we humans create the guff because they get separated enough in their own self-conception. Before that, there was a time, even though you can't use the word time, there is an area where people never died. And that is there, and we're going to tap into that again. And the period where we thought we had to die, we create the guff. So in a way, in relation to having immortality here on Earth, heaven on Earth, the guff is kind of like hell. You know what I mean? It's silly. We didn't have to do it. There are levels of heaven, seven levels, Ion says. And Jesus released hell when he did, the third Jesus did that in his day, you know, 2,000 years ago, whatever. He released the gates of hell. So, but, you know, I can accept that Dawn of the Dead is predicting what Ion's talking about, if you clarify the terms a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll
no, it's the
that.
Opposite of, yeah, it's the opposite of the... of hell. It's the heaven, the zombies from heaven. The dawn of what is, it would be the dawn of the recently undead.
Right. The recently, dawn of the, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, the recently undead. So did you hear from that young lady we had on with Ion? Ever hear again from her?
No, I never did.
Yep, she had a lovely... She got her life changed.
Yeah, I was blown away. Shanti, I think her name was.
Yeah. And she. I like what she said, which is the human dilemma. She said, man, I'm free now. I just hope I don't end up in jail.
I know. It's where I always go.
Yeah, well, you don't have to think that way. You're not going to end up in jail because, well, I don't know why, but... You don't want to have that rule. You don't want to have that limitation about your freedom. I guess it means that you have abandon and you can, you know, inflict anything on anybody you encounter. That would be lead to jail. And I don't think that's freedom. I don't know why you would think that's freedom. Why would freedom lead to jail? But that is a big guilt thing or a socially programmed notion. It's not true. Freedom doesn't lead to jail. Freedom requires responsibility.
Well, yeah, and I think what it is like in America, the way most people's lifestyle is that when you think freedom, you think like you're kind. It's kind of like the way like if you're a Christian, you think of everybody who isn't a Christian as being a secularist, and I think it's kind of like. If you live like within the confines of the American kind of mindset, then the alternative must be an outlaw, which isn't necessarily true.
Yeah, to me it implies that everybody is basically a violent person, a selfish, violent person. And thank God for civilization, because if you didn't have any police or rules, everybody would be pissed and beating everybody up. That's an odd projection of a basic drive in humans.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, the we aren't necessarily that, but, you know, there's been so much technological conditioning or constriction and liberation in the techno-dynamic of American culture that, yeah, we probably intuit that, you know, the chemical body is a seeming dark, misty pool of urges, of rage,
right.
of desires that if you were allowed to, you'd just go rants. You go, what, Mad Max? Is that what it's called? Mad Max? That movie?
Yeah.
Now, in McLuhan terms, you know what's interesting about that? McLuhan says that Americans have a kinetic bias, which is an extension of your feet, the kinetic sense, the movement sense. So railways and cars are extensions of the kinetic sense. And he says that they're also visually biased, and they have a rough encounter with objects. They're so involved with machines that they actually, these mechanical industrial tools of the 19th century, early 20th century, create a sensibility that Americans have a rough interaction with external space. It's a hard-edged thing. And so we have a kinetic bias. And so I was explaining this once to some Japanese people. They said, why are Americans so violent? Why do they want violent images? I said, because they're kinetic. They're not tactile like you, the Japanese. They have an abrupt encounter, an abrupt interface with objects because they're mainly conditioned by the industrial environment. They're the first to really go hog in industry and have all these inventions and city environments. They made Americans like abrasive, not subtle like the Japanese. They're abrasive with objects. That is really what people mean when they say if we unleash everybody would start bouncing off each other like billiard balls because we're a kinetic people. That's never been said before. What?
No. Well, we do that constantly. We constantly say things that have never been said before. And
No, Kurt. I said anybody can mumble syllables. I say explanations that make sense that have never occurred to anybody before. No one's ever explained the American violence in terms of kinetic bias. McLuhan started it, but I completed it.
Why are y'all correcting me, dude?
Yeah. Well, no problem. There is no Kurt. I'm only responding to the words that are said. I'm correcting the words that have been spoken into my ear. Nothing to do with you.
I already forgot what I said. And you know what's going to happen now? You know what you just did? This is going to propagate that image again that our detractors already have. So that's a good thing that you just did.
Yeah, because it makes you look oblivious, and it proves that I did say something never heard before because you didn't know how to respond to it. You couldn't even remember what the response should be. Okay,
yeah,
so let's go to the interview. Where that's supposedly our agenda, and we haven't been doing it for a while.
Yeah, do you remember where we were at with the interview?
Okay, I'm scanning down. Citizenships, what is a day? We did that, day in the life. Youthful, D-cell. I did explain the D-cell, didn't I? How about
last week?
I don't think at this point we're Yeah. Isn't this, I talked about Hillary Dory and how the D-cell was made. That sounds familiar, right?
Oh, yeah. You sort of went into the whole thing like the
Yeah, the history
of
it.
The ice cube trays, and then you had links to those really cool articles from the 70s.
Oh, did you look at those?
Sure.
Yeah, and they're not 70s, from the early 60s and late 50s.
Oh, they're that old?
Yeah.
Wow,
they're
cool.
old copies of the Journal of Borderline Research. I think that was the main little zine, early zine. So we're at the point where we talk about the record. That's where we.
Right.
That's the next part. So you read that part. I first discovered your works. Now we've been over this story many times, so I don't know. We'll just run through it. You know what I mean? There's many. We've discussed this.
No, because we actually did. Because you said Dave stays with Connie and I when he comes to New York City, and then we had a whole big thing about how I asked you if you were responsible, therefore, for getting Dave Neufeld the mansion.
Oh yeah, we did all that. That's on the record.
Yeah.
His whole relationship with Broken Social Scene and all that. Yeah, yeah. No,
right.
That's okay.
So I think where we're at now is the. I'll just read it. Your co-host at the time was Mike Dyer, and he also appears on the records. And then I'm referring to the two Bob's Media Ecology records. And then I say, how did you get involved in the radio show?
Okay, here's my answer. Mike Dyer was a programmer at CKLN, where I was helping Bob Marshall, who was a programmer at CKLN at the time. He started in late August 1984, the week that Truman Capote died. Remember that? And I remember Truman Capote stayed at Johnny Carson's ex-wife, whatever her name was. I just remember that little fact. He used to hang out there. Maybe he died there.
I didn't know
so
that.
Yeah, and so Bob Marshall was on 84 till 89, 90, and I was behind the scenes. I don't get on the radio till 87. So we're talking about how I get on in 87. So Mike Dyer was a programmer at CKLN who offered to broadcast my tapes of Mae Brussel, who had a show on a station near Carmel, California in the 70s and 80s. Do you know anything about Mae Brussel?
Yes, I do. She was kind of like an early conspiracy whistleblower.
Yeah, she was a real journalist.
She had like a radio show back in the day, like in Berkeley.
Yeah, she was one of the first conspiracy people on the radio. I mean, she was doing Alex Jones or Jesse Ventura back in the started 1971 when the Pentagon Papers came out in May 71. That prompted her to go public because she knew she had even more and better information. Because she had cross-indexed the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission. And that led to a year later when John Lennon gave money to Paul Krasner. John and Yoko gave Paul Krasner, who created The Realist, edited The Realist, and got paid for a whole issue devoted to Mae Brussel's explanation of Watergate. And this was in August 72. Watergate hadn't really taken off yet, but she named it up, you know, just laid out who the characters were that were busted at the Hollywood, what they call the plumbers, and explained their role in anti-Castro activities, and they'd link back maybe to the Kennedy assassination. And it's the same team. They were the, what's that guy's name? Howard Hunt's team. So she just had all this amazing information immediately. And she went on a local radio show in Carmel in May 1971. And it was so popular, they invited her back and then eventually gave her her own slot. And she ended up teaching a course and all this stuff at the local college at Monterey, somewhere around there. And Seymour Hersh used her stuff. I mean, she was a really important hidden factor in muckraking.
You actually met her.
Yeah, and I fed her information. And I would always see. I would tell her stuff, and then listen to her tapes to see what extra stuff I didn't know that she'd come up with, because she had a vast archive. When she was dying, I went out there and helped organize the like 50 filing cabinets of articles, all properly filed and indexed, which are now at Santa Cruz University, I think. University of California, Santa Cruz. But they're pretty amazing files.
So she was the real deal.
Yeah. She was the last real journalist. Skolnick was pretty good, and they were good friends. And Skolnick, though, he got fooled by the death of Harold Washington in Chicago in 1988. He had died naturally, but he was fed disinfo, and he believed it. So he claimed that Washington was murdered, and then that led him into the crackpot zone of the 90s. And he actually got lost his way, and so he was being fed information that wasn't reliable, and he didn't know. He'd lost his barometer of what was real. And he eventually got involved, big mistake, he got involved with Nelson Thal in 2003, 2004. And if Skolnick is going to work with Nelson Thal, then that's not good on Skolnick's part. I mean, you know, why would you do crap with Nelson? Because Nelson had gone a little. He became unwell by that time. So, anyway, Mae Brussel.
I didn't mean there, but isn't his new show like really like religious and odd?
Yep. Yeah, it's Herbert W. Armstrong derived from Herbert W. Armstrong and Garnet
right,
and Armstrong.
Right. I listened to that and an episode of Nelson's show, Lenny Bloom, I think he goes by now.
Yeah, and Mrs. Steele and Bloom.
And that was just really, really fucking odd to me. I didn't know what to make of it.
Well, it's so bad. It's so bad. It's bad. It's entertaining, but it's so bad you can't believe the guy is unaware of how bad he sounds.
Right.
He doesn't think he's being.
Unlike me, who is very aware of how bad I sound.
Yeah. But that's good. The more aware you are, then it cancels it out.
Exactly. Exactly. So anyway, why don't we get back to the response?
Yeah,
I didn't mean to digress there.
Yeah, so May Brussel, here's an exclusive. I've said it before here and there, but what May told me is that there was this famous JFK assassination researchers conference in Boston in about January, February 1975. And Nelson Thal, who would only have been 23, he went to that, and he didn't know, you know, he didn't know what, he's too young, he didn't know what he was witnessing, he didn't know there was a May Brussel or a Skolnick, and because when I met him and told him of May Brussel and Skolnick in the 80s, he'd never heard of them. But he now says that he worked with May Brussel and Sherman Skolnick back in 1972 and all this crap. You know, he's like, he probably believes he did, but he didn't even know who they were in 1975. Didn't even remember the conference till I reminded him of it and then who was there. So May Brussel told me that she met Skolnick there, and they had a reputation already then. Time magazine did an article on Skolnick in 1969 because he busted a few of the judges there, state judges or whatever. And I think Skolnick told me this. On the way to May's dying in September, she dies October 3rd. On September, we're heading out there, Carol and I, to see her before she dies, and we drop into Chicago and see Skolnick. And so we get talking about May. You know, he's concerned about May's health and all that. She's dying, apparently, of cancer. And he told me that when they met, they secretly kind of, when they realized they were both great researchers and knowledgeable, they confided that they both used their psychic abilities to track what was going on, their intuitive abilities. And that's what people don't know, that Skolnick and May, they kind of, I don't know how, what the quality of visualization they get in their psychic behavior, you know, it's probably not dramatic, but they can tell. They hear something, see something, they go, ooh, that's what's going on, that's the important person. And they'll follow that and find other stuff. So they both were, you know, intuitives in how they did their journalism. That's why they were great back in the 70s and 80s. So, I mean, so Mike Dyer, he was a guy on Friday night, I think, and then in 85, 86, and I was at a store, maybe the Record Peddler in Toronto, and he walked in, and we got talking, and I was saying, you know, Bob Marshall, originally he just wanted to play May Brussel tapes on CKLN, but it was too long and they couldn't put it on, so he had to write summaries. And so I'm telling Mike about, you know, it'd be really great to have, if only May Brussel's whole hours could be broadcast. And Mike said, well, I've got Overnight Friday, I could do that. So I said, oh, really? So we kind of bonded a bit there, and I started lending him May Brussel tapes, and he would play the whole hour, you know, late Friday night. And he built up an audience for that. A couple of people back then, there was a girl band, all girl band, they would call in and like it. They love May. And so that's what I'm saying here. Mike Dyer was a programmer at CKLN who offered to broadcast my tapes with May Brussel, who had a show on a station, May, who had a show on a station near Carmel, California in the 70s and 80s. Mike did this in the 85-86 period. At that point, Mike and I were mere acquaintances. I would drop off the tapes in his file, you know, or Bob Marshall would. In June 1987, at a CKLN meeting introducing the new station manager, Poonam Khosla. Now, around that, there's all this story. You know about Adam Vaughn. You've heard Greg and Daniel on International Connection mock Adam Vaughn.
Yeah,
that's classic stuff, classic Dobbstown. Well, he fired Bob Marshall in May 87 for playing a beater tape, which Adam claimed wasn't allowed to be played anymore. And
The Peter so Beater, yeah.
Yeah, and so he did that as his last act in May 87 before he resigned as station manager. As a matter of fact, a friend sent a YouTube. He's now a city councilor in Toronto, you know, part of City Hall, a politician. And he recently put out a little YouTube or something where maybe it's his own broadcast within the City Hall closed circuit thing or something that his constituents can see. And he goes on about how great Marsh McLuhan is. But and who his father was a friend of, because Adam grew up near Wychwood Park where McLuhan was, and his father was a friend. His father was a broadcaster, local broadcaster. So Adam, and not many people liked him back then. He knew it, so he quit, and Poonam Khosla came in as the new station manager. So I went to the meeting where Adam introduced her just to see what she was like. In June 1987, a CKLN meeting introducing new station manager Poonam Khosla. Oh, by the way, I'll send you that Adam Vaughn YouTube little thing where he's talking about McLuhan.
Oh, cool.
I got talking to Mike Dyer, who I didn't talk that much with. Didn't really know him that well. He asked me if I had heard of the Church of the Subgenius. I said yes and pointed out how the J.R. Bob Dobbs logo was based on a picture of my father. He was a bit surprised and subsequently asked me to come on his show and prove it. And you can actually go to my timeline and hear that first show on June 17th, 1987, which you've probably heard. You know, you can do it, right?
Yeah, I was working through, like, those old audios because it was cool hearing. I liked it because I heard where the original sound bites from the Media Ecology albums came from.
Yeah.
So it was kind of
right.
A treat, yeah.
Yeah, because that's a major meme in your mental programming is that Bosmi Ecology album, so you're finding out the environments it came from.
Yeah, it's right. Very cool. It's like, that was like the tip of the iceberg, and then now it's like the huge thing beneath it.
Yeah, I mean, people hear that, they hear those archives now, and people from Toronto, I've met a couple of people around here in the States, and they grew up in Toronto, were at Ryerson, didn't know that was happening, they listen to it now, and says, that stuff is so amazing to think that was being broadcast, you know, 22 years ago in my little town, they're amazed at it because it was such a unique show. And now it's being proven literally what's going to happen with ION, what I'm going to do. That's the big thing. Well, you see what's going to happen, Kurt. Anyways, so he was a bit surprised and subsequently asked me to come on a show and prove it. I took up the offer on June 1787, and we never looked back. We became close friends. As a matter of fact, right now, Mike Dyer, who like in 89-90, married another CKLN programmer. Maybe it was 91 they married, but they were living together. Philly Markowitz, who eventually got a show on CBC. They moved to the rural part outside of Toronto. And so they've been there for 20 years. And last September, Mike Dyer and Philly, they were scheduled to leave in August. Philly had was no longer working at CBC, and Mike had a break. So they thought they'd take their two kids, maybe there might be 15 and 11, 15 and 10 or something, and travel down through the States and down into Central America. Just go on a year-long camping trip, take them out of school.
Wow.
So they were going to do that at the end of August 2009, and a hurricane came the weekend before they were to leave and wrecked their barn and everything. And so they had to move and move everything to another place and recover from that, so they were delayed about 3 weeks or a month. So they took off in September, and they just this past weekend, just arrived in Victoria, British Columbia in Canada. They went from Port Angeles, Washington State, the ferry across to Victoria, British Columbia. So they're back in Canada, and you can go on their Facebook. Well, you'd have to be a friend, but you see the whole diary of them going from they went down to Nova Scotia from Toronto back east coast, Nova Scotia, and then worked their way through Maine, down New York, and just worked their way down to Mexico. And I can't remember how far south they went. And then they came back up on the west coast. So a lot of people were, friends of the family. They're posting on Facebook. They're very impressed with this. I'd love to do this with my kid. I wish I did this. You're very brave, And while they were going through down the east coast in the fall and winter, they had that extreme weather this past winter, right? So they got snow in Florida and things like that. So it was not your usual weather typography that you would experience. They actually experienced a bizarre America weather-wise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so that's what Mike did.
If you're never, if you haven't traveled around to, it was totally like reversal of what it usually is.
Yeah, so they're in British Columbia, so they'll drive back across Canada to their home in Toronto. What is this? I guess they'll get there in a couple months, and then the kid will go back to school, and Philly will get another job maybe. I don't know. But that's the update. And so I've been following their Facebook, and they were supposed to meet with Jerry Fialka in L.A., and he Jerry was away when they passed through, just worked out. He'd gone to do his pixel stuff in Ann Arbor or art. He makes art videos using my stuff. Whenever I go through L.A., he'll get me in a studio and tape me saying or doing things, and then he'll stick them into these videos, which I've got to put up someday onto my site. He and another guy, Mark Farina, I think his name is. So, which reminds me, I've got to look right this moment. I'm going to do something. I noticed on Flash Forward that there's a guy, a director named Mark Ovitz, and that seems familiar to me. Is he the guy that worked with Lynch? Let's see, Mark H. Ovitz.
I'm not familiar with him.
Yeah, the name just sounded familiar, and I just wanted to check it. So, yeah, he does Flash Forward, all these TV shows. But where is his bio? Is he the guy that worked? There was a Mark somebody. He probably doesn't. Oh, I'll just look through. Go back to 1988. 1986, Double Disneyland, Davy Crockett. No, there's no Twin Peaks listed in his resume. You know, the IMDb base. The database for Hollywood. It looks like he's not the name I thought, so I don't know him. But I've been wanting to do that for the last 2 weeks, so I finally did it. Which brings me, I have this here, this whole thing that Ion's talking about, the parallel worlding and all that, here is the famous scene of Mike, the one-armed man from Twin Peaks, who defected from Bob. Do you remember that?
Yes. Totally.
And remember, this relates to Mike Dyer. We talked about on Mike's show when Twin Peaks came on in 1991 period, we talked about how they were miming Xenochrony, me and Mike, Bob and Mike. It was right there in Twin Peaks. So it says here, all suspected inhabitants of the White Lodge appear eventually in the Black Lodge. Even the giant appears beside the man from another place inside the Black Lodge. All of the clues and so-called help offered by the giant old lady and her grandson, etc., which help solve the murders, only bring the main characters closer to discovering and finally entering the Black Lodge. An oft-recited poem from the series reads, and this is what I think Mike said when they first got him separated from Bob, "Through the darkness of future past, the magician longs to see. One chance out between two worlds, fire walk with me." That's really talking about parallel world traveling, riff riding. The magician longs to see.
Lynch is notorious for that. I mean, Lost Highway?
Yeah. Mulholland Drive?
Yeah, totally. He's been tapping into that for years.
Right, and I asked, you know, last year, as I got to know Ion, I asked him if Lynch was a parallel worlder and this and that, and he said, no, not so much. It's like Lynch, his films predict what I'm doing with Ion, but he's not as conscious of it when he made this stuff. It just was science fiction whatever.
Are you familiar with his book, Lynch's book, Catching the Big Fish?
Yeah, I actually saw him in New York at the Barnes & Noble take questions, you know, book reading. I saw him talk about his meditation life.
Yeah, I think so. He's probably just picking up on it through
meditation.
Through that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But see, who really knows this stuff that I'm talking about is J.J. Abrams and his, you know, key writers. Did you see this last week's Fringe? Is the most amazing thing you're going to see.
No, I didn't see Fringe. I've still been I've been blown away by Lost.
Yeah, well, that's the same themes. You know, John Locke, the one with the smoke monster in him, that John Locke, he's a parallel worlder. Ion was saying it just to a client today, earlier before I called you, was talking just in passing. It's the same, the parallel worlding theme is what Abrams is bringing to TV. You got to see the latest, go directly to the latest, as soon as we finish, and look at last week's episode. I think, I forget what it was called, but it's on Hulu TV.
Fringe?
It's right there.
Of Fringe or Lost?
Fringe.
Okay.
It's the one last Thursday. I can look it up in a minute and see the title, but it shows, Ion says it's the most accurate description of what happens when you go into another world and see your other self and things like that. It happens right there in Fringe. It's really amazing. And Ion told me personally, like, everybody's amazed at how Walter looks like me and even looked more like me when they went back to 1985, an older scene. Now, there's Walter's other guy, other self has come in. He's from another world. And Ion, I guess, knows, and this will be verified soon. He said, wait till you see that Walter, the new second Walter, when they show him in 1985 when he's younger. He so much looks like you, it's just uncanny. It is weird. Even Ion was saying this. And so that hasn't happened. I guess it's going to happen this week that we see the two Walters interacting in 1985. Because right now it's 2010 and the two Walters are happening now. So we'll see if Ion told me ahead of time a particular event that's going to happen in the upcoming episode. Because I think there's only one more episode this season. J.J. Abrams, he uses a medium, a second medium, and he has a previous medium who died. According to Ion, we're outing Abrams, he and his writers. They use a medium that told them all about the parallel world. And that's what they're sticking in Lost and Fringe. And that, and so they know about it more than Lynch did, so to speak. Because if you read up about J.J. Abrams, he cites Twin Peaks as an influence on him. And if you look at Mulholland Drive, if you remember the director, the young director making the movie in Mulholland Drive with the blonde from Deep River, Ontario, Canada?
Yeah, he even looks like J.J. Abrams.
That's the point. He looks like – you knew that, or you're just thinking that, or you just checked it now, or what?
No, I just suddenly realized that, like, he totally looks like J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, and that's – Mulholland Drive is – when did that happen? 2002 or something? It's a while ago. Long before Well, wait a minute. I'm going to just check that because that might have happened right when J.J. Abrams was getting ready to do Lost. So – so we look up Mulholland Drive. Get that. His name is Julian or something. Mulholland Drive movie. So characters. Okay. Justin Theroux. Okay.
Right. That's
so,
the actor.
Okay. What was the year of Mulholland Drive? Justin Theroux looks like J.J. Abrams. It is 2001, so that's before Lost starts. But you don't make Lost unless you've been doing some stuff and getting attention for yourself a couple years before, right?
Right.
I assume. Okay, I'll look up.
He did Alias, and he wrote some screenplays. It's funny because I just looked J.J. Abrams up yesterday.
That's why you have his image in your mind, fresh, and you can relate it back to.
Yeah, and so when you said that, I was like, oh my God, he does look just like him.
Right. So that's right. So look, if you look at, I'm looking at the Wikipedia. Let's see what he's doing in 2001. I mean, let's assume Lynch doesn't know J.J. Abrams, but he was picking up the major guy of this decade in TV. Right? J.J. Abrams is probably the most successful guy, right?
Yeah. He's kind of like what that Chris Columbus was with X-Files.
Yes. So here is Lynch, you know, accidentally predicting the guy because he has a character, an up-and-coming director in Hollywood who looks like Abrams. So trying to look at the career, where are some dates here? Abrams directed and wrote the two-part pilot for Lost and remained active producer before that. Created ABC's Alias, when did he do that? TV series, September 2001.
Yeah.
So 2001. So he's right. The Mulholland Drive comes out right around that time. So it's actually tuning into a guy who's accomplished enough to have a major show on ABC. So maybe even Lynch knew about
it. And that was a show that, you know, had Jennifer Garner in it and even had cameos by David Cronenberg.
Oh, okay. What was it about? Let me just read this. The main theme of the series explores Sydney's obligation to conceal her true career from her friends and family, even as she assumes multiple aliases to carry out her missions. What is she? Oh, she's a CIA agent. Okay. These themes
but
are most
like
prevalent.
She works for a fake CIA, which is actually a cabal of assassins, and then there's a real CIA.
She
so
doesn't know
even,
that she's duped?
She's duped, yeah. And so even that, it's kind of
that's like
that
a parallel
of,
world. That's like a parallel right. world CIA.
Right, that's what, like, a big, I think a big, and like I told you, I don't know if you've seen his reboot of Star Trek.
No.
The J.J. Abrams Star Trek, but that totally, what he basically did was he reintroduced Star Trek to like a newer, faster Star Trek, but he kept the original, within the original Star Trek universe, and he created a parallel reality within Star Trek.
The same theme, the same, that's his main
yeah.
life theme.
That yeah, it goes through just about everything I've seen of him.
Is it a good show, the Star Trek that he did?
I think
like
it's
it?
Really good. I mean, as far I'm not, I've never really been a big Star Trek fan, and I felt like it was really it was fun. You know, it kind of went back to the original fun Star Trek. You know, it didn't take itself too seriously. Because you know the old Star Trek kind of. Or the newer Star Treks kind of took themselves too seriously.
Mm.
They went
okay.
from like that. Yeah, you get
okay,
it.
So yeah, we're talking about well, why? Okay, we're talking about Mike Dyer. Why did we get on to this Abrams-Mahone drive? Oh, Jerry Fialka. Fialka footage. But anyways, so Mike Dyer, he was ostensibly going to visit Jerry in Venice, California, you know, a couple of months ago now, I guess, yeah, maybe March, he was in, maybe April, he was going to be in L.A. So, they did couch surfing. There's this network, you know, as a family, you find other families who will open their home for you to crash a night or two. That's what Mike and
his wife. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's called Couch Surfing, I think, network. It's an actual way. Low-budget traveling, and so they couch-surfed all the way down the East Coast and maybe even into Mexico and up the West Coast. So they could have stayed at Jerry Fialka's or friends of Jerry's, and so I posted a footage of me entering Jerry's home back in 95 or something. We're coming home from visiting the Museum of Jurassic Technology. You ever heard of that museum in L.A.?
No.
Yeah, it's an amazing fake museum. Look it up, Museum of Jurassic Technology, J-U-R-A-S-S-I-C. It's probably got a wiki entry. And Jerry, I went over and we had a dialogue with the director, you know, the fake Bob Dobbs with the fake museum. And it's pretty weird. It's pretty weird what happened. Like nobody could tell what was fucking. We squared the fakery, you know, so to speak. I was like hallucinating when I came out of it, or I remember it was sort of disorienting. And we drive home back to Jerry's, and there's a videotape in the car of us talking about it. And I posted that on Mike Dyer's blog, say, here's where you're going to stay, because the camera follows us into Jerry's little cottage, you know, in Venice. So if you go there and look at it, that would be summer of 96, like when, you know, whatever videos on the timeline for 96, 97 in that period where it says we visit the Museum of Jurassic Technology. You get to see the entrance to Jerry's home, a legendary place, Fialka Funny Farm. Major Zappa activity took place there among the fans.
Oh, okay.
I mean, many of those interviews of me are done in Jerry's little home right there in 93 when my bride and I lived there for 6 months. That was when we first arrived in the. We were on our way to New York, but had to go to L.A. first for the treatment for AIDS that Carolyn was working with. So, why did we get into J.J. Abrams though?
I don't know. I kind of got lost.
The Justin Theroux.
Oh,
no, parallel
world.
I brought up Twin Peaks and Lynch, and then reading this quote. That's what it is. Through the darkness of future past, and Ion's always talking about how the future is placed in the past to activate your present. He plays with the past, present, future dynamic. Through the darkness of future past, the magician longs to see one chance out between two worlds. That sounds like singing. So if you go down, they have a footnote. Why one by chance? Where's the? That's funny. You click on one. It is unclear if the third verse reads one chance or one chance. Is it C-H-A-N-T-S or C-H-A-N-C-E? I would go with C-H-A-N-C-E. One chance to experience this. One chance out between two worlds. Firewalk with me. Then it says, in the final episode of Twin Peaks, Dale Cooper meets a man from another place who refers to the Red Room as the waiting room, possibly a link between the two lodges. That would be a rift. The rift is between two worlds. It's what it means to one world, from one world to another. Only when the man says, firewalk with me, does the realm erupt into flames and then descend into flickering blackness. This is arguably the moment at which Cooper has finally entered the Black Lodge. The red curtains, zigzag floors, and bright spotlights of the white and black lodges have also appeared in several David Lynch's other films, suggesting that Lynch may view their influences as ongoing. Their influences as ongoing in his narrative worlds. So which was the man from another place?
That's Michael J. Little Michael Anderson, right?
Oh, that's the little dwarf.
Right.
Yeah, the guy who talks backwards.
Right.
He is an inhabitant of the Black Lodge, a realm of pure evil. Early on in the series, the man gives Agent Dale Cooper clues to apprehending the man's nemesis, Bob. He later makes recurring appearances in relation to the Black Lodge. Okay. I didn't know the dwarf was called the man from another place. Okay, so back to Mike Dyer. And
he's also called the arm.
The what?
The arm of the one-armed man is the dwarf.
He's the arm.
Yeah, they called him the arm as well. I remember that.
So you studied Twin Peaks? You know the details of it?
I'm a huge Lynch fan since I've been...
Well,
like,
we ought to... Did you know that the Lynch movies are about me? Well, of course, everything's about me like that, but we ought to go into some. I'll tell you about that.
We'll do a Lynch episode next time.
Yeah, let's go into, you know,
I know
with
you, you did an audio commentary for Inland Empire.
Oh, yeah, did you hear that? Or maybe that's not
I
up yet.
I haven't yet. No, I think it's
no,
up.
I think I have it
in my archive.
Yeah, no, Scott taped it. That's right, because... Bob Marshall and I did a showing of Inland Empire at the Innes College on the University of Toronto campus in October 2007, and that was videotaped by different people, and Bob Marshall wants to organize it and edit it or something, and we've never put it up yet, and he's supposed to be doing it, and here it is, you know, 2.5 years later. We haven't done it, but that might be interesting. Us, you know, it's an addendum to the commentary I did with Scott that you're talking about. But there's this other footage of us doing it with the public.
Oh, no, that's cool.
Yeah, no,
Lynch
is...
And you did
it
with Mike Dyer back in the early episodes.
Yeah, during Twin Peaks.
You and Dyer talked about Lynch a lot. Yeah.
I didn't know about Twin Peaks, and Jared Fialka and Carolyn and Don McBrady and Sue Bone, Tara Wise... Jerry Fialka, we went to Trinidad and Tobago. Is that the place? I think we went to the Tobago part of Trinidad. Is that what? Do you know what I mean? What's the?
I'm not
those
sure
islands?
About Trinidad.
Yeah, Trinidad and Tobago. I think that's what it was. We went there, so we were on a boat for a week or two and going around the Caribbean, and coming back on the plane to Toronto. And this would be April 1990. I'm reading, you have to read magazines on the plane. So there was a Time magazine. It was a big article after the first week of Twin Peaks, and it's like the peak period for David Lynch. He's big, you know. Everybody likes this opening show. He's mainstream success. You remember that period when Twin Peaks started off? Peak recognition in the Android meme.
Oh, yeah, and there was like people were like kind of, they were like using, I mean, they were like the Simpsons, they were doing like all kinds of like, it just really kind of took over the culture there for like 6 months.
That's right, from April. So I'm reading in Time magazine. I had no clue because I didn't watch TV much what was going on. So I'm reading about the first episode of Twin Peaks, and I just read a bit about it, and that was that. I didn't rush to TV and do it, start following it. But by August, September, they reran them. And for some reason, I decided to watch it. Maybe I was just hearing about it more and more. So I watched the first episode. And when Dale Cooper says, what I really want to know is, what does Marilyn Monroe have to do with JFK? Do you remember that statement?
Yeah,
totally. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the sort of the interesting angle. And I said, wow, I know all about that. And I said, what is this? So I started watching it, and it just, the synchronicity with me, which I call synchrony, just went on every week. And so I said, shit, I got to talk about this on the show. So I reviewed whatever that first 8 weeks was that they replayed in the summer. So I caught up in the summer. So my commentary is during the replay of the first season, so to speak. And then after that, I was up with everybody else following it through the whole, till the end. And yeah, that's when I did commentary. And in 93, let me see, Jerry Fialka used to get audio tapes from another guy named George who would tape the show, and he'd send copies of the Mike Dyer Bob Show. And there was, so all that David Lynch commentary –